All right, well, let me talk a little bit more about a couple of the hindrances that I've noticed over the time of studying and working with congregations. But one is this strong notion of entitlement that really underlines any sense of ourselves as receivers of gifts. Paul Tournier, the Christian psychologist, some of you may have read years ago, he once said that no gift can bring joy to the one who has a right to everything. No gift can bring joy to one who has a right to everything. And I think if we're entitled to everything, we're grateful for nothing. And so I think that's a difficult issue. There's a healthy notion of entitlement. There's always sort of subtle issues here. Because there's a notion of entitlement that's tied to a sense of personhood and dignity and rights and so on, equality and equal regard. That's not what I'm talking about. But when that's really exaggerated, it brings continual dissatisfaction and an incapacity to see anything as a gift. And some of you may have endured phases with teenagers in your house where they sort of thought that they were the center of the universe and they were entitled. You know, everything revolved around them. It's a very difficult stage. The problem is that for some people, they don't ever outgrow it. And, you know, there's a sort of a chronic sense of entitlement and dissatisfaction that everybody owes them some kind of debt. And life can be difficult in those circumstances. So entitlement is one issue. A second one is this sort of chronic grumbling. And grumbling is highly contagious, very destructive to community. Again, think about the children of Israel in the desert. After their miraculous deliverance, turn toward grumbling, and with pretty significant consequences, actually. I talk about in the book C.S. Lewis's story in The Great Divorce, some of you are familiar with it,
yeah.
Where they take the bus into Greytown, and it's an amazing little story about the practice of grumbling, and he talks about how someone can go from grumbling to becoming a grumble. And that's a significant shift there. All of us do occasional grumbling. But and that's different from sort of making grumbling a way of life or part of your identity. And he talks about starting out in a grumbling mood, but then eventually the grumble takes over. And he describes it as going on and on like a machine, like a grumble machine. And that's all that's left of the person. So that's the kind of, he captures the picture of the misery of a person who, all that's left of the person is the grumble. Actually, it's a terrible image, and the antidote, once again, is gratitude. I think grumbling or complaining is a little bit more complicated than that sometimes, though. And I was reading the Rule of Benedict. Are some of you familiar with the Rule? There's quite a lot of attention to grumbling in the Rule, partly because grumbling is a major threat to community. So the Benedictine Rule has governed Benedictine monastic life for 1,500 years. And the grumbling is seen as a threat to communal life and goodness. And so it regularly warns against brothers who grumble. But actually it shows remarkable sensitivity to circumstances that can cause unnecessary hardships. So it warns the leaders not to do things that will cause what Benedictine calls justifiable grumbling. Which I think is interesting because I think especially leaders can use the critique of grumbling as a way to silence legitimate dissent and criticism. Quit your complaining and so on. But really, the complaining is a legitimate critique, and so I liked that sort of language of justifiable grumbling and warning that you need to be careful that what you're doing is not causing legitimate complaint. Legitimate criticism and dissent are not the same as grumbling. Of course, it's easy for leaders to complain about our congregations and communities because there's always something wrong. War stories or complaints about difficult congregations can become pastors' chief topics of conversation when they gather. Dietrich Bonhoeffer warns pastors, though, not to complain about their congregations, and certainly, he says, never to other people, but also not to God. He reminds us that we have not been entrusted with congregations so we can become their accusers. And then another terribly destructive intrusion into community life is envy. And that's what we're starting to talk about, which is sort of the classical deformation of gratitude. Envy is wanting what someone else has, but that's like coveting and oftentimes jealousy, right? Envy has an added evil to it, and that's that you want it so much, you also don't want them to have it. And envy often reflects a lack of confidence in our own giftedness and ingratitude for what we do have. So Thomas Aquinas wrote that envy is sorrow for another's good. And that is about as appalling as a statement as you can imagine, right? Sorrow for another's good. Just as gratitude might be seen as the parent of all virtues, envy often leads to other sins and deformed practices. And because it's so ugly, we tend to hide it. And then that ends up involving deception and secrecy, secret betrayals, and so on. Henry Nouwen writes that we can only fully enjoy God's generosity toward others when we truly know how much God loves us. And I think, again, that's an important warning that envy is Kierkegaard talks about envy as a small town sin. We envy people who are like us. This is one where it's often fostered in close proximity. We don't compare ourselves to somebody who's like rich and famous and all that. We compare ourselves to people who are like us. And that's why envy flourishes in small communities. And it's all sorts of versions of it. But mostly it's hidden and it has fangs and it's very hard to defang it unless it's brought into the light. So I think that's a pretty major deformation in community. It isn't always easy to be thankful to God in all circumstances, as we're called on to do, but it is downright complicated sometimes to figure out how to be grateful to other people in all circumstances. There are complications in the practice of gratitude. For example, we don't always want the gifts people give us. Right? Why is that? Have you ever turned down a gift?
I've returned it when they're not.
Turn down the offer of a gift.
Okay, turn down the offer of a gift. Yeah, well, sort of. Yeah. Yeah. Why?
You want to kind of pushing it back on them, not to inconvenience them, and to not, you know.
Okay.
There's
an
expectation of return that I cannot.
Strings attached.
If there's strings attached, then I can perceive that. I'll just be like.
Right. Every gift has strings. I mean, the notion that gifts have no strings is just they're not exchanges, but they still, because they create a moral bond between the gift and the giver. Sometimes we turn it down because we don't want the bond. Or we don't feel like we can repay it, or it represents something that doesn't represent how we're feeling about the relationship. So gifts create a moral connection between the giver and the recipient. Sometimes that's good, sometimes it's problematic. Again, think about the times that you've refused a gift, and think about why you did it. Sometimes you don't want the connection, sometimes the gift is inappropriate. Think about turning down a gift in ministry. Or to a ministry. Have you ever had to do that?
Yes.
Sometimes it is because strings are attached.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it pushes. I had one guy sharing with me that, and I share that in the book, that somebody gave a donation to this ministry that was a sort of a youth program. And it was the youth program was going through all of these convulsions. It was a very difficult period. And they gave a gift to send all of the staff and kids to Disney World.
Oh.
You know, that kind of thing, which was a very strangely timed gift.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I know from experience that sometimes people give gifts to organizations with an expectation that it will move in a certain direction that may not be the direction that you're wanting it to go. I tell in the book, I was teaching, actually, I think it was the hospitality course at Asbury, and it was in an intensive format, so a lot of people had flown in or driven in for the week. And after class, maybe the first or second day, two of the guys said, "We want to take you out to a really nice meal." And I thought, I actually really highly value eating with my students, but this was a little bit different, right? I hadn't graded, I hadn't done any of the grading. You know, and those, so I had to say no. No, thank, I can't do that. Even though I really valued their kindness, their offer, but it represented connections that really were inappropriate to the roles at that point. So gift giving actually is very complicated. And we don't respond to every gift in the same way because gift giving deepens the connections. And every gift is not what we always wanted. Some of them are troublesome, as I was saying. But on the other hand, and this is the difficulty so often, it's terribly important to people that the gifts that they offer are valued, especially their contributions. Again, Nouwen says that we'll never recognize our gifts if someone isn't there to receive them gratefully. But some gifts actually reveal misalignments in relationships. And so we ask ourselves, what is this gift saying? Do they know me? Do they know us at all? And so on. And again, one of my experiences here was years ago when I was working actually with refugees and with in a community that was pretty substantial need. I was working in a thrift store. And I don't know if how many of you have volunteered in thrift stores or whatever. Sometimes it's astonishing what people, quote, donate, right? I mean, dirty, torn clothing. Actually, we received gifts that were wrapped of kids' toys that were broken. And, you know, you kind of, we learned you have to actually open them to make sure that they were okay. And you start, you know, you kind of look at it and go, the person who donated this, what were they thinking? What were they thinking about the people who, first of all, were doing the volunteering, but then also, what were they thinking about the people who would need these things? And so I think sometimes that kind of donation can really be very revelatory, and not always in a very good way.
I have a case in point. My phone is blowing up here with a lady wanting to donate two old sofas to the church.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like right now, as you're saying this. I didn't respond to her text last time, so she just called me and left a voicemail. And I think many times, not necessarily this lady, but we donate stuff to make us feel better about the new stuff we're going to buy anyway.
And sometimes donations can be very helpful. We want to recycle things.
It's a bit of a gift, a guilt tax.
Yes, it could be that. And also sometimes, depending on what condition it is, it you know, it becomes an alternative to throwing it away. And so then you sort of want to ask, what are we saying here? We often say, and this is getting back to what you were saying before, that giving gifts, there are no strings attached. And gifts are not the same as purchases or exchanges. But every gift has strings, because it's tied to the deepening of relationships. Because the recipient of the gift is expected to respond with gratitude, evident in that person's behavior toward the donor, but oftentimes also toward the gift, sometimes even toward third parties, depending on what kind of gift giving it is. So it's grateful conduct to the donor and grateful use of the gift. Because there's a bond and some expectation, when gifts are trashed, it's very painful. So this is sort of the other side of that. Think about how it feels when you give a gift away, maybe something that's really quite valuable to you, and you later discover that it was carelessly discarded. How does that feel?
A number of years ago, we gave a gift of a nice grand piano to a church. And I'm a music teacher by profession, so that was really, really, really special. And we discovered that the pastor's son was taking his toy trucks and running them all over the piano and scratching the piano all up. And we felt very, very bad about it.
It's actually painful because somehow in giving gifts, part of we're in a sense giving part of ourselves sometimes. I think one of the issues that often comes up in congregational life is volunteers giving gifts. Like, so somebody spends a lot of time cleaning the kitchen or working on the yard, and then somebody else comes along, often unknown to each other. I mean, not that they don't know each other, but the situations, and completely messes up the kitchen and doesn't clean it up, or drives over the yard and, you know, puts all sorts of ruts in it and stuff. It's striking how hurtful that is, because somebody really has invested themselves, their time, their energy in fixing it, and then it's not even acknowledged by how it's treated. And it's not enough then that somebody said thank you. It's the grateful treatment of the gift that also matters.
This is reminding me of a friend who's a student pastor in Toronto, and we took our students there for a mission trip, and he took us on City Walk, and inevitably the subject of homeless comes up, and that was something very dear to him. And of course, all of the I was serving in Indianapolis at the time, and all these good, you know, hard-line, you know, conservative kids had been taught, oh, you know, you don't give money to someone, they're going to spend it on drugs or alcohol or yada yada. And my friend Blake, in his orientation, he said, you know, the way I've come to be convicted about this is that God gives me an income, and I absolutely am never the best steward of the gifts that he gives me. And so I'm thinking about, you know, we give a gift to someone and they don't value it the same way that we do. Well, God gives us things that we obviously don't value the same way he does. And does that then also turn a light on us? Did we give them something because we love it, or and we assume and we hold them to that they have to value this the same way I do? Because that's unreasonable.
That's a great point.
Right.
And I think actually what that does is point up the tension in this experience of sort of sharing gifts. Because it's both and, isn't it? That we give generously, graciously, with open hands, right? And yet, if people don't say thank you, so you give it not expecting thanks in
return.
It's
really hard to do that.
It's incredibly hard. And I think part of the reason it's hard is because when people don't say thank you, it does say something about the relationship. And that can be painful. Even if we're fairly secure in ourselves, it does say something about the relationship and how the person is responding. So I have a friend who runs a homeless ministry, and he says one of their commitments is really to they have about 25 people on staff, and it's like they don't do what they do for thanks, right? They do it as unto God, as an act of worship, and it's given to God so that they're not dependent on the people they're helping to say thank you. On the other hand, Keith sets up opportunities regularly for people to say thanks, because it's very hard to sustain a genuine relationship if people don't act respond with gratitude. So it's this. I think it's a dance, and I think the issue actually about whether somebody deserves something, like when you're doing a handout or something, is a tradition, is a discussion that goes all the way back to the early church. So Augustine is much more strict. Chrysostom is like, why do you have to be exact about a man's life to give him a piece of bread or something, right? Why do you have to know what he's going to do with it? Just give it. God's given it to you, and so on. So there are tensions in distributions of alms, but it's a challenging thing in terms of the gratitude piece.
I do think it's a good leadership practice to constantly be thanking people.
Yes.
We volunteer for the National Park Service and just cleaning horse stalls. And those people will see you and walk 50 yards to come over and say thank you.
They're
just trained to do it.
I think it's huge, and I think it actually does start with the leadership. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of reasons why it's difficult, and we try to be efficient, and there's too much to do, and we're afraid if we start we'll overlook somebody. Nevertheless, it's an incredibly important part of sustaining community.
There's an interesting thing about culture on this as well,
yeah.
Because especially in Japan, if you go to somebody's house, you don't walk in without a gift.
Right. Gift giving varies very significantly across cultures. And we were just talking about some of the complexity in certain Asian societies where the reciprocity dimension of it is very complicated, because it's sort of an exact exchange. And I think That actually, when it brought into the church, makes life very complicated. But I think it does help to know that there are cultural differences and not to read them negatively, but try to understand what's sort of standing behind the complexity. I mean, something like gift giving seems like it wouldn't be that complicated, and yet when you start looking at it, it's very big differences. Also, in grateful communities, it's not always easy to know how and where to acknowledge people's contributions, especially the quiet, kind of undramatic ones that aren't so noticeable. And also, as I was saying, if we get into the habit of offering thanks or recognition, we worry that we might miss someone. And sometimes we do. But another one of the difficulties is that gifts come to us oftentimes in broken people. And finding a way to be faithful and thankful to them and their gifts, but simultaneously dealing with the difficulties they bring can be challenging. So lots of times, volunteers who want to help are also very troubled. And sort of learning how to value that, but to walk with them in fidelity and truthfulness at the same time is really important. Because sometimes the troubledness, the brokenness is actually dominates, is more significant even than the gift. And so it can be challenging. I tell in the book the story of from one pastor who was telling me that he had this guy in the church who was incredibly gifted. And I think this probably happens for many of you who are in music. You can have really gifted musical people who also still somehow bring lots of baggage with them. It's not just that happens in music, right? But there, I mean, sometimes they have wonderful public gifts, right? But there's a lot of brokenness in their life, and the brokenness sometimes complicates the gift that they're offering. In this case, it was a guy who was incredibly good working with youth, but he had some really big entitlement issues where he always thought the world owed him something, where he got very angry very easily, you know, and so on. And so, and almost, not exactly harassment, but it was moving in that direction if he didn't like what you were doing. And eventually it became extremely problematic for the congregation. And there were some of the folks in the some of the leadership who were ready to say, we're done, this is it. He had wonderful gifts, mm-hmm. but the gifts were accompanied by so much brokenness. And so some of the people were ready to ask him to step down, and then one of the leaders said, you know, it's not just about the gift, it's about the person. And they tried over the years to walk with him in truthfulness and faithfulness, that was what they decided that they wanted to offer to him, was to come alongside. There are people who volunteer to teach a Sunday school class or lead a Bible study who actually, I mean, they may be very good at teaching, but they're terrible at small group relations because, again, they get angry or they dominate or those kind of things. And figuring out how to receive the gift, but also to sort of work with the brokenness in the giver, I think. That's a lot of our experience with volunteers, isn't it? You know, nobody's completely transformed. So, yeah. Gifts come in broken packages. Let's talk a little bit about the way that your congregation or your leadership does sort of foster a culture of gratitude. What are some of the things that you're doing in the various parts of communal life that foster gratitude? And then if some of the challenges come up along the way, that's fine too.
We make testimony of God's provision and thankfulness a regular part of each Sunday in our worship. And one thing I mentioned to the group here is when we do send resources out, like a check or other monetary resources to the organization, we don't want to just write a check and it be gone. We will give God thanks for the resources that made that possible. And then we come together as a church and we come around and we pray over and give God thanks for those resources even before we send them out.
Wow.
So it's something that's really part of our every Sunday experience.
That's great. Good.
I was mentioning to our group that we are kind of junkies when it comes to sending cards to people and being real specific, handwritten with one of those stamps on it, and getting something tangible instead of just the pat on the back.
sort of the personal affirmation, and you just kind of make that a style, part of the rhythms of the of life. Yeah. I share in the book when, for years, when I've been teaching at Asbury, there were several senior male colleagues who used to write me just like two or three lines pretty regularly when they would see like an article that I had published or hear that I had done. And they would just say some affirming thing about, you know, they read the article and wasn't it good that it was, you know, published there or something. And then a line about how glad they were I was at Asbury. And that was such a special thing. And, you know, I mean, I knew they were really busy with their own publishing and teaching and things, but it just it meant so much. So I thought that was a very special practice. So when I hear about churches that do that, I realize if you get into the rhythm of it, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
But it makes a huge amount of difference to the people who receive it. I think that combination of sort of structured time for thankfulness, the building into it every week, the testimony time where people share their gratitude, begins to sort of shape a community in particular directions. My friend who leads the community for with homeless people, one of the things that they do is every night, I mean, it's sort of a version of grace before the meal, but they gather together, so that's the staff, the volunteers, and the residents who have been homeless. And they just spend a few minutes talking about one thing for which they're grateful. People don't have to do it, but mostly they do. And you know, sometimes it's catch-up or parents or, you know, a good day at school or something or other. But he has found that actually shifts the culture of that kind of transitional housing, where that's the first thing that people look forward to as they're sharing a meal together. And because in his situation there are also opportunities to offer criticism and concerns and that, it doesn't feel coercive. Occasionally it can be coercive if you demand that people regularly say thank you and express gratitude and so on if there's underlying problems. What else? What other things are you doing? Yeah.
I work in a church that's reasonably large with a fairly large staff, and it's very easy to get siloed in our ministry areas and be completely focused on what we're doing and unaware of what's happening outside of that ministry. So when we have, twice a month we have a staff meeting where our entire church staff is together, from the custodians to the senior pastor. And almost always at those meetings we have a point in time where we tell Yay God stories about what's been going on in terms of transformation in people's lives or in our ministry areas. Now that not only focuses on gratitude, but allows us then to see and understand what else is happening within the church in ways that we don't necessarily get to see face to face.
Excellent. Good.
We have an annual volunteer appreciation where we recognize children, youth, adult, lifetime, hold up people on an annual basis and gives opportunity to talk in general, good things God's doing, thankfulness for being together.
Yeah, great. I was working on some of this material in a number of different contexts, and I have come up in communities against or I don't know if against is exactly the right word, but people who are concerned that affirmation can lead to pride and being puffed up. And so as a culture, and this was true, it was interesting, it was I heard it when I was in Singapore, I've heard it in Britain, and I heard it among the Dutch Reformed folks that I was working with, that there is a sense that if you offer affirmation, people will be puffed up. Is that true in sort of for any of you in your sort of communal culture? Because it was a little bit foreign to me. I think affirmation can border on flattery if it's not truthful, right? I mean, we're not just sort of saying things to make people feel good about themselves. We want to affirm real things. But I think we have to recognize that, again, culturally, this is a slightly complex understanding, differences, and so on. Although I think in some cases, anyway, those cultures would benefit. In fact, one of the ones in Britain said, oh no, actually, there was a German woman who said to me, well, we don't really do affirmation, but we like it when Americans do. Okay. So that was, I thought that was an interesting sort of, again, sort of cultural differences.
Yeah, I was recently reading, watching lectures by a Chinese professor talking about the difference between Western culture and the Chinese culture, the way people think. And he had some things saying that he was doing for management. And he said, when your boss is telling you that certain, speaking to you very loudly, he is not just talking to you, he's speaking to whoever hears it. If he wants to tell you how good a job you do, or how he'll do it privately. If he's talking it loud enough, other people can hear it, so he's talking, let him give a message to the rest of the people.
Interesting.
So in that vein, if the pastor or senior pastor in Sunday worship, single out a certain person to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. The message might be that, how about the rest of the people, you didn't do as good as this one.
Uh-huh.
That
uh-huh.
kind of thing.
I see. I see.
From that, I can.
That's interesting.
I understand that the way. So then the people would feel, how about all the rest of us who
uh-huh.
did something that's valuable behind the scene.
Right.
How about us?
Like right. And I think that expressions of gratitude can be manipulative.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there can be sort of hidden agendas. And again, that's a place where truthfulness and deception and gratitude intersect. And grace intersects. I think in general, becoming cultures of grace and gratitude probably involve becoming more intentional about the practice, and it sounds like people are, not in a mechanical way, but in sort of a more organic way, building life together around praise and testimony and thanksgiving. Telling the stories, so the biblical stories of God's grace, the community stories of the experience of God's grace and faithfulness, and then the personal ones as well, so that it becomes kind of a whole culture of thanksgiving. Really, in a sense, making space for gratitude. And more specifically, articulating the ways in which we're blessed, not just the general kinds of expressions, but more particular, and that give testimony to the goodness of God and those around us. For some people, beginning each day with an expression of gratitude to God and to those around us, and ending the day by recounting moments of grace and goodness has really been life-giving. I've known a number of people who've been able to make that a practice. Because we do become a grateful community through daily, ordinary acts of gratitude and remembering. I think as you all have grasped pretty clearly, you cultivate the practice of gratitude in the church by having the leadership model it. And steward one another's gifts. I think that's part of, especially around the issue of having volunteers, is of really valuing their gifts and stewarding them, working with them faithfully, giving opportunities so that gifts actually benefit the community. And I think we can become more adept at noticing what's good and celebrating it. And one friend of mine described the joy of what he called catching people in the act of being a gift. And I think that's a delightful way to think about the ways in which people are gifts themselves. Not what they give, but just who they are. Sometimes they're gifts to the community. Some of you are probably familiar with Marilynne Robinson's Gilead. Have you read that? It's the most beautiful book, Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. It's the story of an old preacher. Who has a young son. And at one point he says, this is a quote from the book, "I'm writing this in part to tell you that if you ever wonder what you've done in your life, and everyone does wonder sooner or later, you have been God's grace to me, a miracle, something more than a miracle." And I think that hearing from another person that you have been God's grace to me is a very powerful experience. It changes how we experience the ordinariness of our own lives and the sacrifices that we often make. But seeing ourselves and our others as expressions or embodiments of God's grace can transform life together. You have been God's grace to me. as I was saying before, we can be more intentional about creating structures in which we regularly have opportunities to express gratitude and celebrate gifts. I think I overheard you guys talking over there about sort of a deformation of this, where you have to continually list every gift anybody ever gave. Is that what somebody was, one of you were talking about? And I'm surely not talking about that, but finding ways in which we celebrate, and it may be just a corporate celebration sometimes, of just the ways in which God has blessed us through one another. I think one of the other important things we can do is get better at helping people leave well. I mean, not trying to get them to leave, but when they do leave. Communities usually do okay with expressing gratitude when a person retires, or when they move away, or when a family moves away, or whatever. We do that okay. But we struggle with expressing gratitude and appreciation to people who leave under more difficult or awkward circumstances. So when there's a layoff, when people leave due to church disagreements and so on, at best sometimes we let them float away. But oftentimes we don't recognize, and sometimes these people have been part of the community for a very long time. And there's no acknowledgement. And it can be pain. I think part of the reason we don't do that is because it's painful. But I think it's also an extremely important moment for healing, where, you know, we may recognize that there's going to be a separation or there's loss. But there's also, at that point, a chance to sort of gather up the contributions that people have made and the goodness, the ways in which they've meant something to the community, and find a way actually to move forward from that, where we actually express and cherish what we've shared. I think gratitude and thanksgiving oftentimes make the other practices beautiful. Hospitality that flows out of gratitude is life-giving. For both hosts and guests. If it's grudging, it's actually not good for anybody. And gratitude flourishes when the other practices are vibrant. So, you know, gratitude, again, without truthfulness ends up being flattery. Gratitude without fidelity is also kind of a strange deformation. For followers of Christ, there are endless opportunities to offer thanks. I love a quote from the English theologian William Law in the early 18th century. He talked about the joy of greeting each new day as a personal mini resurrection, just sort of waking up to another day. Thinking about receiving, he says, each morning as the beginning of a new life, a resurrection from death. Meet every sunrise with such sentiments of God's goodness as if you had seen it and all other things newly created on your account. And under the sense of so great a blessing, let your joyful heart praise and magnify so good and glorious a creator. So I think that reflecting on how we can create environments of gratitude really could challenge us. It could challenge us at the church level. It can also do it in terms of families. How we might interpret ordinary activities differently. And if you think about, you know, back to the various levels of gratitude, so gratitude to God, and then gratitude kind of as a way of being, and then gratitude to one another, you realize that there are infinite opportunities to cultivate gratitude. And ultimately, gratitude is a response to grace, and therefore it's inexhaustible. It becomes a spring. It is a nourishing practice. Because if our ministry does not spring from gratitude or from the sense that we live graced lives, I think ministry will break us. Mm. It's simply too hard. The wisdom and discernment that we need for it, the grace and love that we need for it, even fidelity and truthfulness, they're all almost superhuman. Well, they are superhuman, aren't they? What's required. And so really, in the end, it's grace and gratitude that allow us to continue, that nourish our work, and help us to continue, really, to represent Christ.